the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I'm very uncomfortable right now with my bank asking me what I'm going to use my money for when I start taking money out. This has been the news this week with HSBC, but it's an attitude, isn't it?
Well, if we don't already have an Orwellian context, you know, you've got suspicious activity reports regularly being filed by banks on the basis of subjective appraisals of client behavior. What might be suspicious? Well, it's interesting. HSBC gives us, I think, an insight this week. Suspicious behavior from a banker's perspective is wanting your money back.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think I'll take a little bit of cash out, please, which is, I think, why I had the money in there in the first place.
So what are you going to use that for?
Well, that's the question that they're asking.
Well, that's not a good enough reason. We'll give you less, but not what you requested.
You know, if you get on the internet, you can read story after story of HSBC customers now coming out and saying, you know, I couldn't get $9,000 out because the reason wasn't good enough.
Or seven, or five, or four, or three. I mean, quite frankly, if a bank will not give you your money when you request it, no reason given. I suggest that you take all of your money out. Why? Because if they are so reticent, I mean, it's almost like removing the scales from someone's eyes. Wait a minute, you mean you'd actually have a hard time giving me such a small amount of money? How well capitalized are you? I mean, I think it goes a long way towards showing just how frail the banking system is. What has changed in recent decades is the nature of being a depositor. A depositor used to reasonably expect a return on capital for the use of that capital by the bank for the purpose of lending into the community.
Well, and give me a break. I mean, talk about return. I mean, we all have gotten our end of year statements, and it's like, why even put it on your taxes? I don't care how much money you've got on there. It's like, okay, so I made a buck.
But with a bank, you should never be asking the question, not return on, but return of. And if they won't return of, in other words, they won't give it back, again, there's a different sort of dynamic afoot. Your money center banks now derive far more profit from trading stocks and bonds than they do from lending to corporations and individuals. We know that's been shrinking, and that's reflected in your velocity numbers, where basically the liquidity created by the Fed and various world central banks is not getting into the broader economy. But as a depositor, you now, this is the changed relationship, no longer lending into the community and capturing some percentage of that for your own benefit, but as a depositor, you're nothing more than an unsecured lender to the institution.
That's what I'm talking about, attitude, Dave. Last February, we started hearing about this new concept. It was a new word called bail-in. And if you were in Cyprus and you had deposits over 100,000 euro, you were expected to pay your dues back to the debt of the country. I saw something yesterday, Dave, on Japanese banks are now saying, why don't we tap into inactive accounts, accounts that haven't been touched in 10 years, and start paying back some of the debt that we have in this country?
Absconding with, what is it, $100 billion? I mean, it's no small sum. Now, granted, it's not big enough to make a difference in terms of their fiscal picture. That's a disaster, and it's on a scale that, again, you're talking about a spitball in comparison. But when you go to that concept of being an unsecured lender, when you're a secured lender, you're first in line, you have a protected interest, and you're not paid as much. But as an unsecured lender, you should be compensated handsomely. Is that the case today?
Well, we're making just fractions of a percent. So let me ask you, Dave, why do I put money in the bank? I mean, it's a habit, I know. I've done it since I was a kid. When I get paid, I put money in the bank, and then I go spend it. But why does anybody keep money in the bank?
And I think that's really the basis on which we operate most of the time, is autopilot on the basis of behavior which has become ingrained.
Right.
The biweekly check goes in, you withdraw money, and you assume that you're receiving something in interest along the way. They help facilitate the transaction process. Maybe you've got auto bill pay, and they facilitate that. You know, is it the interest that keeps you coming back?
It's not the interest, but you know, you had mentioned something. Some of it is the convenience, Dave, like the auto bill pay, that type of thing. So I guess the question is not why do I put money in the bank, but why would I keep anything significant in the bank?
Right. In either case, I have to say there's very little value added. And now there is a growing concern over the attitude in the banking community, which confuses whose assets are whom. There's an implicit expectation that your investment or your consumption decisions should be known,
right,
and should be traceable. And I'm sure the NSA loves this, but bankers, under the guise of know your customer, are being trained to create an expectation of disclosure.
Right.
And then run it through sort of the Big Brother suspicious activity reporting grid if something doesn't seem right.
Well, and I think we should bring up that reporting over $10,000 coming in or out of the bank in cash has been the norm since 1986. I mean, the banking secrecy laws that came out at that time, the form number 8300 had to be filled out anytime someone took $10,000 out. But now it's more on a discretionary basis. That's what HSBC had a policy of really until a couple of days ago.
Well, Kevin, that's specifically cash transactions. And I think this gets to the issue. Cash is suspect for the same reasons. Ultimately, the precious metals are suspect by the larger establishment. There is privacy and anonymity in transactions. They're outside the view and outside the control of regulators.
Right. It doesn't mean it's illegal
no.
what you're doing, but they want to see everything that you're doing.
It's really presumption at the highest levels of government, and that has set the standard. We now have snooping and government-to-citizen espionage. I mean, that's just ridiculous, but the only thing more insulting and angering than our government spying on us directly is the creation of a culture where we spy on each other and consider it a duty.
Well, David, sad. We clearly have not been taught, at least the last few generations, about the communist bloc, and the schools just don't bring out what privacy was and why it was important constitutionally.
If we could dust off sort of the recent Eastern European history books and compare regulatory overreach, which we have today, corporate policies reflective of the same from that perspective, I think we'd see that, you know, again, the snooping and knowing of everything, the documenting of everything that everyone does. You can assume the best about your leadership, and we do, but we do have the historical record which says that politicians themselves change over time
right.
because power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's from the 7-volume book on the history of liberty by Lord Acton. That notion is well established in the historical record, but it's not just an individual being corrupted. It's also that you can go from one person in power to another person who may not have the same respect for individual autonomy and sovereignty.
Yeah. Well, you know, also, I've talked to younger generation people who it's just normal to be on Facebook and sharing just about everything in your life. It's strange, Dave, but this seems not to bother the younger generation like it does us because they have really somewhat given up their autonomy.
And it's interesting because it is very easy to communicate with friends and family. And if you were doing that in a private world, that would be normal. And we'd love the technological innovation which enabled that direct communication.
Right.
But sort of the notion that it's not just direct. It's direct, and it's also to the cloud. It's also to infinity. You know, in every area of life, we are careening towards statism and the elimination of individual autonomy. You would expect this in an era of groupthink and social compliance. And that's really what we have built into our education system today. I find it very disturbing. But again, the inability to think for yourself, the notion that social compliance, I remember sitting on a plane with a gentleman and he was very angry. We were 2 minutes after the door had closed on the plane and I was still turning off my phone. And he knew how dangerous this was to the avionics systems of the airplane. And I just looked at him and I said, you know, I'm almost done. It's not that big of a deal. And he said, you have no idea what kind of irresponsible behavior you're presenting to your children, because my son was sitting right next to me. And I just leaned over to my son and I said, son, this is an example of someone who's been well-trained to be compliant with every rule, and someday we will find that these rules are completely irrelevant and don't affect the avionics of the plane. But he is a good trained monkey. Granted, I wasn't all that respectful, but I felt like I was being attacked for no good reason. And I was moving towards compliance anyways. Now, as we know, you can have your phone not in communication mode, but you can have your wireless on. You can check your emails. You can check your stock quotes. Why? Because actually, it's social control. And again, this notion of individual autonomy, you just need to find your role in social compliance. That's the expected mode today.
Well, and they're resetting what's normal. And, you know, we talk about during quiet times and when you're not in a crisis, that's really not that big a deal. But in a crisis, Dave, they'll put on draconian controls. Now, I want to go back to the bank because I asked you the question, why would we put money in the bank? And even going back to the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, we realize that the banking system itself is just a gigantic facade with very little core value.
Now, if you remember the Jimmy Stewart comments, he said, you know, Sally, your money is not here. It's in Joe's house. And no, Tom, your money is not here at the bank. You want it, but I don't have it. I lent it to Sally. What is amazing to me, and I think you need to never, ever forget this, your local bank, if it's a small institution, they keep less than $50,000 to $75,000 in-house.
Well, Dave, and I know we can't name names, but don't you have personal experience with this, with a withdrawal over the last few years?
Oh, sure. Yeah. In the summer of 2008, I requested a certain sum of money, and they said, well, listen, you know, that put us in an awkward position. This
was, Dave,
not a large sum of money.
It wasn't a lot of money.
No, it wasn't. But nevertheless, they said, you know, could we split that up over 2 weeks? Because we'd have to make a special order to have more money on the floor. That's a small institution. What about the larger institutions? You know, you could pick your national franchise, but at any of your branches of a national franchise bank, you can have less than $200,000 on the floor. Your money is not there.
Right.
And I think when you look at this HSBC policy, they're not alone in this. Not only is the money not there, it's not yours.
Right.
Provide the reasons you need it. What are you going to spend it on? And then consideration will be given to releasing funds.
It sounds ludicrous, but it's the new norm.
My suggestion, keep 3 months' expenses on deposit, eliminate all other bank exposure. You're living in an era where you need to ask this question. Is it prudent to be an unsecured creditor? Is it prudent to be an unsecured lender? And I suppose if you were being compensated adequately for it, you might have one response. But if you're not being compensated as an unsecured lender, then look at your bank relationships in a slightly different light. Or I guess you could keep faith in the sort of solvency and wherewithal of the FDIC. But frankly, when you do that, you're just putting lipstick on the pig.
Well, speaking of lipstick on the pig, okay, the Federal Reserve is going to either raise or lower quantitative easing, but that's going to be dependent on a growing economy.
Yep.
I mean, they're going to look at the economic numbers, and these numbers have been disappointing, Dave.
Well, you've got durable goods numbers, which were disappointing this week, and that's being largely ignored, with media attention going to positive earnings from Caterpillar, Honeywell, and a few others. And boy, the market does not like lower expectations in the future. Very few exceptions. Share buyback schemes, which we've talked about, they continue to sort of perpetuate the myth of a booming global economy and improved earnings, present and future.
Well, let me interject, Dave, because not everyone maybe has heard the last couple of shows. When you're talking about share buybacks, what you're talking about is reducing the amount of shares outstanding, and that increases the earnings per share. It's not illegal, but it is a way of making things look better than they are.
Right. And you would hope that a company is looking ahead and saying, we've earned this capital. We've risked capital in the marketplace. We've grown our business. Here are the revenues. Now we want to grow the business. Here's how we're going to do that. We're going to buy out a competitor. We're going to improve and increase our research and development. We're going to come up with a new product. When they go to sort of buying back their own shares, it's because there's nothing else better to do with the money, which again is something of an indicator of what the opportunities are from an economic standpoint, the opportunities or lack thereof. And the fact is, if you're not going to be able to grow your company organically, you might as well continue to receive your bonus as an executive by seeing your numbers continue to improve, even if the economic backdrop doesn't foster growth in the underlying business. It's not organic growth. That's what I'm saying.
And these are big numbers. I mean, Honeywell, $5 billion. Cat, $10
billion. Yeah, and Honeywell, they announced that in December. They're in the midst of a $5 billion share buyback. Caterpillar, they just released plans for a new $10 billion share repurchase. They have positive numbers. They have great revenues. I appreciate all of that. But understand that there are some issues along the way which have to be taken into account. Now, in terms of future expectations, you've got Apple. Apple dropped 8% in the aftermarket this week, suggesting that the next quarter will come in close to 10% below expectations. You had the iPhone sales, which didn't meet expectations, even though they were record numbers. And you've got new contracts which have been signed and products being distributed to China. That's where I think conditioning is critical. The market conditioning of expectations is a key form of manipulation used by corporate executives with the support of the media to keep Joe and Susie Lunchbox coming back to the market.
Well, David, I know you're interviewed often, two or three times a week on national financial TV, but I mean, CNBC, that's a dying breed. It's just falling off the cliff at this point as far as viewership.
Well, yeah, and I guess this gets to just how sensitive the markets are. You know, I mean, for the numbers to come in better, revenues to have increased for Apple, and yet the stock sells off 8%, investors are conditioned to believe that tomorrow is going to be better on every front. And if it's not better, as a multiple of growth from the previous quarter, the previous year, et cetera, oh, well, our expectations have been disappointed. They've been dashed. You mentioned CNBC. It is dying. And this really runs contrary to past periods of prosperity where viewership was increasing alongside economic growth.
Right.
And the stock market, their gains were growing in lockstep with a thriving economy.
So you're saying it's different at this time?
Well, we conclude it is a little bit different this time. Viewership is awful because the average citizen is not better off. The economy is not improved. We have asset prices, which have improved. The middle class, they're in a different position altogether. They need an income boost. So even with asset price appreciation, you still have the balance sheet of the average American floundering. We have 8 million homes that remain underwater. You've got 1 million of those in California, 1 million in Florida. You've got the foreclosure pipeline, which has shrunk with home values rebounding. So, yeah, I mean, granted, this is an improvement. We don't have millions and millions of homes in the foreclosure pipeline. Now there's only 1.2 million homes in the foreclosure pipeline. Last year, this was remarkable. 336,000 homes were bought by Colony Capital and Blackstone off of bank balance sheets out of sort of the REO pipeline. That reduces overhang. That's positive.
Yeah, but that's not the general person coming back in and buying. This is a large, like a hedge fund, coming in and buying those properties.
Exactly. It doesn't signal a return of lending. It doesn't signal the middle class sort of gaining confidence. Those homes represent, actually 336,000 homes taken out of receivership, if you will, they represent the crushed hopes and dreams of hundreds of thousands of one-time homeowners, now renters.
Well, and we're looking at an economy that's been on life support. We call it quantitative easing, okay? So it was $85 billion. Now it's $75 billion. The Fed's meeting this week to determine whether they're going to go up or down. But the thing is, we're still in need of this life support. So when you look at the fact that the economy is not growing, Dave, let's talk about the Fed. We've got Yellen coming in. She's replacing Ben Bernanke. What are we going to see?
Well, the chances, of course, anything can happen, but I think the chances of further reduction of QE is unlikely. You look at the last week, 10 days of behavior in the emerging markets. You look at the stock market here in the United States having 3-4 off days, and it sets the market on edge. Now, the question is, will Yellen be sensitive to the markets being on edge?
Yeah.
And basically say, hey, we took $10 billion off out of quantitative easing in the last meeting, and we will probably do the same thing at some meeting in the future, and we're still looking for confirming evidence that the economy is improving. If they don't take another 10 off the table, move it from 75 to 65, you'll see a nice rebound in the stock market, knowing that the Fed still has the back of asset prices and of the stock market specifically. If they do take another 10 or more off the table, as has been encouraged by Dallas Fed President Mr. Fisher and others who are a little bit more inflation hawks, if you will, concerned that the liquidity created could create future problems far greater than any that they've been addressing in the past through quantitative easing.
It's been so strange living in this era of quantitative easing, Dave, because actually when bad news comes out about the economy, it's seen as good news by the stock market because it's like, oh, good, it's still bad, so they're going to still put money in. But
still putting in that artificial lifeline.
You don't talk often on this show about technical chart types of things, but the S&P 500's been interesting, and you've mentioned that to us, and I think it'd be worth looking at.
Sure. So if you assume that the Fed remains highly accommodative, buying assets, you know, billions each month,
right,
and they keep rates very low, you know, a couple of things. One, I mentioned if they do not take away another 10. Yeah. They met yesterday. They met today. You know, this is the issue. The S&P broke down out of what's called an ascending wedge pattern, and it should rally back over the next several weeks. If it does, you may be developing the right side of a head and shoulders top. We already have two-thirds of the pattern in place. If the last segment is completed over the next 10 days of trading, the subsequent breakdown targets 1,700, potentially lower. And our long-standing concern is not that we revisit 1,700 on the S&P.
Hmm.
That would be, frankly, a very shallow correction off of the recent peak numbers. Ordinarily, you'd see a 20 or 30% correction given the amount of gain that we saw in 2013. Of course, no one in the financial media wants to embrace that idea, but frankly, it's more normal than you'd think. 10% corrections happen all the time. 20 and 30% corrections are not out of the normal.
The thing is, in this particular case, there's so much margin owning those shares. There's so much debt owning the shares. So if you have a 10% correction plus, there's a point where people have to liquidate their shares.
That's our longstanding concern. A normal correction of 10% could be exacerbated by a deluge of margin account liquidations. What do I mean? When investors borrow from the bank to buy stocks, the clock is ticking. And that investor needs to be proven right quickly. After all, you're paying interest for the privilege of using someone else's money to speculate with. Mm-hmm. When you begin to lose someone else's money, you can either receive calls from the lender to add money to the account, or you have to sell assets and repay the loan in full.
That's called a margin call.
Yeah, and so December's numbers for margin, that is money borrowed to go speculate with, they edged up 5%. Now, think about this. When you're talking about an already record number, to move that needle 5% is a big deal. We went from 423.7 billion to 444.9 billion in margin debt.
That's an all-time high then.
It is. And this is a lot of potential liquidations. And for past perspective, we've never seen record margin loans without subsequently seeing an unwind of those purchases. And we're talking about $444 billion in liquidations.
Almost half a trillion dollars in liquidations.
So previous peaks in margin debt were in the year preceding a catastrophic decline. So we had margin debt numbers peaked in 2007, followed by major problems in the market 2008. We had margin debt numbers peak in 2000 with major problems in the stock market in 2001. We had major margin debt peak the early part of 1987.
Right.
And that fall, not a different calendar year, we began to see an unwind, 20% in one day. So the same thing in 1973. Now, I mentioned this on Fox Business this week with Jerry Willis. You don't want to be caught in that avalanche. It's not a market timing device, but it is another one of those very important canaries in the coal mine.
Yeah, and we talked about canaries last week. We talked about you have to watch certain indicators, and you know, you have to look outside of the borders. Talk about a story this last 3 days in the emerging markets. My gosh, everybody is starting to say, what's an emerging market? Even people who don't follow it anymore.
Our last discussion with Russell Napier, November 13th, covered in detail the high probability of emerging market chaos in the near future. At issue were the growing quantities of loans taken on by a variety of countries that would be coming due, but they're denominated in another currency. They're foreign denominated bonds.
And I think that's important to point out. We as Americans can borrow in our own currency. When it goes up or down, we're really just either printing or paying it back in our own currency. But gosh, Dave, if you're in another country and there's a currency move, it can cut their throat.
Well, and what we've seen, you know, looking at various charts on the emerging markets, it was in November that the emerging markets indexes began to move lower in earnest. There was an initial move lower May and June of last year. It recovered through the fall, and then it started tipping over in November. Select countries had reached a tipping point even earlier in the year, but with the index for emerging markets coming under pressure severely in November.
Well, one of the arguments on those indexes dropping, though, Dave, is that the Fed has begun tapering this quantitative easing and the impact that that not only has on us, but has on these emerging markets. And why don't you name a few of the emerging markets so people know who we're talking about?
We're talking about South Africa. We're talking about Brazil. We're talking about China. We're talking about Turkey. We're talking about Argentina.
The South American countries.
Yeah, on multiple continents. This is not a continent-specific issue. It's not even a country-specific issue. But there's a couple of elements here. The argument has been that the Fed is going to reduce asset purchases, known as quantitative easing. They floated that idea in the spring of 2013. That started the pressure in the emerging markets. And indeed, emerging market currencies and bonds were the first to be negatively impacted. Then you had the emerging market equities, which followed and have continued to deteriorate since this last fall.
Well, and it's not just the Fed. I mean, the Bank of Japan also has been easing, and that's, you know, we saw the downturn in their own currency.
Well, and for us, this is not axiomatic for those in the financial media, but it goes without saying for us that Fed and Bank of Japan liquidity provisions have magnified risk.
Right.
Lower rates and ample money have promoted speculation, and it also changes the way people view risk. Not only have insurance companies and pensions had to take on more risk to meet income expectations, but you've also had households doing the same thing, increasing risk and buying every manner of bond on the planet with a higher yield. The world is income starved. It's not just here in the United States. But that is a course that the Fed has served up on a silver platter, not last year, not 2012. This goes back 5 years now, with interest rates held at an unnaturally low level.
Well, and what it's done is it's forced people who would never take risk in the stock market, or very little risk in the stock market, to throw everything in either a stock market or an emerging market, or something that can take that money away very quickly, versus a very consistent bond paying a reasonable interest rate.
I saw in Bloomberg this last week that the average yield on a 10-year government bond, if you combine all of the developed world countries, is 0.63. That's less than 1%, but 0.63. This is a 10-year piece of paper. So they just averaged it all in, and of course you've got Japan, and you've got the euro, and you've got us here in the United States. And they're basically saying, if that's the case, if you can't get any money in bonds, why not get 3% in equities?
Yeah.
You know, I can choose a blue chip, I can increase my income component dramatically, but what you've just done is increase your risk profile considerably. If you think of the insolvency sequence, a company goes into insolvency, or a country for that matter, the bondholder, the secured creditor, is paid first. The stockholder is at the very end of the line. You may get nothing. Once the company or whatever is liquidated, guess what? You get the scraps, if anything.
Right.
But you're willing, for the sake of income, to completely reappraise what is normal risk to you, and do that without reflecting on just how impactful the Fed and Bank of Japan liquidity provisions have been. Yes, they've magnified risk-taking, and they've also covered over the implicit risk in the investment markets by depressing yields.
Speaking of depressing yields...
They are depressing.
Let's put that 0.63 into perspective. You know, it used to be if you had $1 million, that was a pretty good retirement nest egg. But what we're talking is $6,300 a year. Can you live on $6,300 a year at 0.63 on a 10-year treasury?
It was a Financial Times article, just to correct. So anyone's looking for it, it was a Financial Times article, not a Bloomberg article from the weekend.
So Dave, being a millionaire at this point, you have to go into the stock market to actually earn more than that $6,300. You can't pay bills on that. That's below poverty wage. So
you're better off being a millionaire and moving to Hawaii and putting yourself on welfare. You're going to receive more in welfare checks than you would a millionaire receiving income on your deposits.
And this is what's causing the speculation. People are saying, look, I'm backed against the wall. I have to put this in something that I may lose.
This is the destruction of the rentier, as Keynes described it. It's a process by which the socioeconomic class, which has assets and which generates an income from them, you can call that the rent, if you will, they're pressured to speculate or spend those assets in the absence of sufficient income.
Mm-hmm.
Keynes and other economists, they've looked at savings as a problem for the economy. In their mind, it's less grease in the gears. And so then you have sort of this financial repression implemented by Ben Bernanke. Zero interest rates, been with us for 5 years. He's handing that baton on to Yellen at this point. It's a part of this economic legacy. I mean, they inherit it from Keynes, of driving money into the market by disincentivizing savings with rates that punish behavior. You know, saving and investing, you think that's normal behavior? You think that's healthy? I do. You do. But the central bank would say, no, your money should be in the economy, and we need you to spend it, not save it.
Well, and aren't we being retaught that there really is no risk in what you're talking about, these risk investments? Because the Fed, they've already told us, look, if it's too big to fail, we're going to just come on in and bail it out. They've programmed a response that unfortunately can't continue or be sustained.
Well, and the problem is they continue to intervene in the markets at higher and higher levels.
Right.
You know, which means that ultimately when a large bailout is needed, you wonder how much ammunition they have left for a real financial firefight. You've got the Fed asset purchases. They have, yes, they've increased the speculative elements in the market. That's what we've been talking about. Now they're pulling back. Took away $10 billion out of the $85. That leaves them with $75 billion in asset purchases each month. And that does alter the risk landscape. Even the suggestion of it last May and June began to alter the risk landscape. We've seen the foreign currency markets getting a jump on that for the last 9 months. But as many commentators point out, it's the equity investor that gets it last.
Right.
Foreign currency investor, the bond investor, they are to a degree smarter than the equity investor. They started pulling funds when? Oh, last spring. And it's no surprise, again, that the foreign currency markets have been anticipating this. And it's just now moving to the forefront of the equity investor's mind, the equity market route in the emerging markets. Let's look at this in theory, and then let's consider a couple of countries working through the proverbial meat grinder. currency crisis, that stirs credit crisis. What do I mean by that? If we can linger on this point, it's a very important one. When you have countries which borrow from other countries and do so in the lender's currency, let's say Argentines borrowing in dollars and not pesos.
Right, like we were talking about before. They're at our mercy to a degree when they borrow that way.
Well, any devaluation of the borrower's currency raises the probability of default by making it more difficult, more costly to pay back the debt.
So what you're saying is, okay, let's say Argentinian dollars, let's just do 100 and 100 to start with to make it easy. Don't use the currency changes. So let's just put this on an even playing field and see how this works, Dave. Argentinian pesos borrowed $4. Let's say it's 100 and 100. They're not equal, but let's say they are. And then the Argentinian peso devalues. Now, to pay back that same amount of dollars, they have to come up with more Argentinian pesos.
Right. And the problem is they earn their livelihoods not in dollars, but in pesos. So you have to have more economic output. You have to have more income just to pay back the old debt. The hurdle, if you will, to be able to pay it back is that much harder. Now, we've had a 35% devaluation in the Argentinian peso in the last 12 months. 15% of that came last week.
Which means their debt is going to cost that much more to pay back.
Right. And again, this may seem like an insignificant issue, but liquidity from the Fed, along with record low rates, have spurred an unprecedented dollar-denominated debt binge.
Yeah. Well, why wouldn't you? I mean, if the currencies didn't move, why wouldn't you come into the United States and borrow dollars?
Rates are cheap. Yeah. I mean, you look at it from just the level of interest rates, not necessarily foreign exchange, but just interest rates. You tell me, would you like to borrow in Argentina for 8%? Or would you like to borrow 10%, 11%? Would you like to borrow in the U.S. markets at virtually nothing?
But it's not just the United States. I mean, this is happening also in Japan.
Well, you look at anywhere where there's been huge financial repression. In other words, the central bank stepping in and taking rates below a natural level.
Right.
And you're going to see people taking advantage of those cheap rates. This happens a lot with the yen, has classically to a smaller degree with the euro. But, you know, central banks, again, U.S., Japan, Europe, Britain, they've eased lending conditions. Mm-hmm. They've been issuing credit or loans denominated in their own currencies. And emerging markets have been only too happy to lock in low rates. The terms have been compelling because, frankly, they've been unrealistically low.
Right. They can't do it in their own country at that rate. Now, let me ask you a question.
And they should not be able to do it in our own country. It's, again, you're mispricing risk. And this is all compliments of the Fed, the Bank of Japan, and what we would call central bank activism.
Isn't this a world version of what Germany did in Europe with the countries that are on the outliers, you know, like the Cyprus's and the Greece's? They came in and got German rates, which were lower.
Right.
In a country that should have been higher.
Right. And so what you had was a mispricing of risk, people taking too much risk, people developing things which they shouldn't have been developing. Property development in Spain, which never should have happened, except that credit was mispriced. Spanish credit was not the equivalent of German credit, but Spanish credit was being treated like German credit.
Right.
Therefore, lowering of rates caused a real estate boom and a subsequent bust. Is it any wonder that 5 years on, we've gone from a debt crisis to a debt crisis because the only thing we infused into the debt crisis was more debt?
Yeah, but there was somebody to bail out the European crisis before. We were very involved in that. There's no one left to bail out except for, oh my gosh, the way we started this program, the actual private individual. Because the IMF at this point has talked about, they've floated this twice now, that we should have a one-off 10% wealth tax and everybody just try to pay off this unserviceable debt. Is that coming?
Well, it was disturbing to see the German central bank, the Bundesbank, make that same suggestion this last week as it applied to all your peripheral European countries. They would say, hey, listen, it's not our problem. Oh, we're not going to bail you out. But here's what we should do. If you're an Italian and there's an Italian banking problem, we should look at the net worth of the average Italian and they should take some sort of a hit and that'll recapitalize the banks.
That's that same attitude we addressed earlier.
It is. It's not your money. It's the system's money. You need to think corporately. You need to think about your social contribution. But listen, it's privatized gains on the one hand, socialized losses on the other. And if you're a good socialist, as you should be, as you've been trained to be, then you just ante up. Again, we've got emerging market currencies they are reflective right now of 2008 and 2009 levels of dislocation and concern. Think about that. We don't have a global financial crisis according to the media. We don't have a global financial crisis or economic crisis according to the most recent reports from the IMF and the World Bank. And yet, if you look at where the South African rand is, if you look at where the Turkish lira is, if you look at where the Argentine peso is, they are signaling something very different. They're signaling chaos in the underbelly of the market. Now, what's the underbelly? The underbelly is the money market. The underbelly is your cash rates. The underbelly is, again, your currency exchange. And to see a number of these currencies be upended in the last 6 to 9 months, with it becoming much more dramatic, coming under intense selling pressure this last week. Oh, boy. So last week, Turkish lira fell 4.4%, Brazilian real 2.3%, Russian ruble 2.9%, South African rand 2%, Chilean peso 2%, the Colombian peso 1.5%, the South Korean won 1.9%, the Argentine peso, as we mentioned, 15.1% last week.
This is how much more items are going to cost in those currencies.
No. In Argentina, they depreciated, they devalued by 15%, and costs rose by 20 to 30%.
Which is the real inflation rate. I mean, is it not 26% inflation rate right now in Argentina?
No, the official rate's 11%.
Oh, yeah, that's what they'll tell you.
But then the IMF has gotten all over the Kirchner government saying, this isn't realistic, you're lying to us, your statistics are fabricated, 11% doesn't reflect the cost of goods and services the way we calculate it, and we've tried 10 different ways, it's 26%, not 11%. So you've got understated inflation, you've got store owners looking at a 15% two-day devaluation in the Argentine currency, and they've got inventory. They don't want to sell it too cheap, but they don't want it to be expensive. So literally in a matter of 2 days, you know, a washing machine goes from 21,000 pesos to 27,000 pesos. It gets marked up 20, 30% in a matter of days. Why? Because the shop owner doesn't want to lose his shirt. Now keep in mind that the exchange rate now, Argentine peso to dollar, is 8-1. And that's not the blue dollar rate. The blue dollar rate is what they call the black market exchange rate.
This is if we were really doing it on the street.
13-1.
Yeah.
So you're actually looking at a depreciation or a devaluation, which is 60% worse than even the news media would say. Because that's what you're dealing with in real time on the street.
This training, David, we've talked about training our impulses to the new norm. And we've been trained that the Federal Reserve or central banks in general can come in and intervene and control whatever they need to control. Now, we've started to believe that as a society. Not you and I, but I'm talking as a society. Yet, look at what happened with Turkey a couple of days ago. They intervened.
Well, exactly.
It didn't stop.
How well did that work for them? They spent $3 billion trying to prop up the currency from collapsing further.
The chart just kept falling.
It didn't do a thing.
Yeah.
It didn't do a thing. You know, South Africa, again, you're back to 2008 levels. Brazil is under pressure. Indonesia is under pressure. Malaysia is under pressure. Venezuela, that's a basket case. 56% rate of inflation this year. And a lot of this ties into our China thematics. We've been fixated on China for a better part of a year, knowing that the way they went would be the way that the emerging markets go. They really are the tip of a much bigger emerging markets iceberg. And the fact that this last week, the PMI numbers, the Purchasing Manager Index numbers declined below 50, does signal, this is the HSBC PMI dropped to 49.6, the expectation was actually for a positive move, that's a further confirmation that you have weakness in China. Ergo, weakness in China, less demand for copper from Chile, less demand from iron ore from Brazil, less demand for any commodity. Is it any surprise that the Australian dollar is breaking down? We talked about canaries in the coal mine for deflation last week. Is it any surprise that the Canadian dollar is down, that the Australian dollar is down? As goes China, so goes the commodities complex, and most of your emerging markets, with a few exceptions, are tied to the commodities trade, very sensitive. So we have all of these themes coming into play. At the same time, the Fed is saying, by the way, we're pulling back, not going to have as much money out there as you'd hope for.
Well, and this debt is coming due at the same time as well. And just going and looking at this, Dave, Reinhart and Rogoff wrote a book called This Time It's Different. And they showed century after century, what was it, 8 centuries that they looked at, where countries would go into debt, and then they'd default on their debt. And they'd go into debt, and they'd default. Now, we're not talking about the United States here, because we borrow in our own currency. We can print our own. But do we see an Argentinian default coming? We almost had a major default in China, but someone came in day before yesterday and snuck in a bid and basically bailed it out just in time.
Definitely government stepping in to bail them out. They learned from Lehman, and they know that even though it is a $1.7 trillion industry, this shadow banking industry in China is more like $4.8 but about $1.7 in these financial products. $1 trillion, by the way. So, you know, what's $500 million in the context of $1.7 trillion? Gnat on the backside of an elephant. And yet they did see that if they didn't bail it out, they could have major systemic problems.
I wonder if they wished back in 2007, Dave. I remember when Bear Stearns came out with $400 million worth of what we now call toxic debt. It didn't sell. I wonder if they look back and go, you know, we should have stepped in and just gone ahead and bought that. Maybe we would have avoided a Lehman.
But you ask about Argentina. It is reminiscent of the 1997 Asian crisis. Argentina is trying to preserve its dwindling central bank reserve position. So what they've been doing is they've been taking their foreign exchange reserves and they've been intervening in the market to prop up the Argentine currency. They made the decision this last week to not spend their dwindling reserves on that effort. And that's why you have a 15% decline in one day, because they basically backed away from the market. But keep in mind, when you have shrinking reserves, that serves as a trigger for hot money flows. When central banks get nervous, think about this. When central banks get nervous and start sort of protecting the eggs that they have in their basket, investors get nervous and they start protecting the eggs that they have and they start pulling it out of that particular basket. All major speculative trades run into trouble when your carry trade currencies start to strengthen, whether it's the dollar strengthening, the yen strengthening, relative to the devaluing currencies. Does this make sense?
It does.
And the money's got to go back. The loans have to be paid back, and they can't afford for the gap between the place that you've been speculating, that asset class, whether it's bonds, stocks, currencies, what have you. If you start taking losses there and you're beginning to see an appreciation in the lending currency, you're going to get squeezed, and you're going to get squeezed hard, because keep in mind, this is a leveraged bet. Kevin, we have more leverage in the system than we've ever had in the history of mankind.
So let's have a moral to the story as we end this up, Dave. Okay, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying stay liquid in the things that are the safest, whatever that would be. Don't put too much in the banking system, and definitely don't be speculating on the market, especially on margin at this point.
I think you need to recognize that quality is not protected. You know, many people will say, well, listen, if there's going to be a problem with the bond market, by all means, go to a corporation that pays a decent dividend and has a history of the last 30 to 40 years of increasing dividends. Let me explain a market panic and the dynamics in a market panic. Quality is not protected. In fact, it is often the go-to for liquidity. It's not unusual to see your best quality companies initially take a far worse hit, because as people are clamoring for cash,
there's a bid, at least for the better companies.
At least they can get something, and at least they're not taking an extreme haircut to get their money out. Whereas with a smaller company or whatnot, you find that liquidity dries up, and all of a sudden the bid-ask spread is horrendous. So I think in this environment, you're looking at emerging market weakness. You're looking at the stock market in the U.S. It's taken its first little trip up. I'd say the first loss is the best loss. Yeah, maybe we have a rally in here. As I mentioned, technically, that rally could form the right-hand shoulder of a head and shoulders top. That could take weeks, that could take months to form. If it takes months, understand what we're putting in is one of the larger tops we will have seen in a long period of time. What I'm suggesting is that 2014, if we continue to see sort of pulling back of the Fed, deterioration in emerging market dynamics, an inability to pay, potential defaults and impacts into the credit markets, as we were seeing in China even through the last couple of weeks and days, you have the makings of a 30 to 40% decline in the general equities market. Are you prepared for that? Do you have enough in cash? Do you have enough in gold? I'd suggest this is the time and place to batten down the hatches. If you're sitting fat and happy with large wins from the equity market, large wins from the bond market, you know, maybe this will be the one contrarian comment for the day. You probably have 6 to 12 months of a benefit to being in U.S. Treasuries. I don't like U.S. Treasuries. I think that on a longer-term basis, they're anathema. They shouldn't be in your portfolio. But to the degree that we continue to see a meltdown in the emerging markets and that transfers over into the developed market equity space, guess what you're going to have?
There'll be a rally in the Treasuries.
A rotation into Treasuries.
Right.
And to some degree, a rotation into gold. But that is the safety bid. That is the safety play. And I think for anyone who's thinking from a macro 3, 5, 7 year planning perspective, how to grow and protect your wealth, this is a perfect opportunity to be reanalyzing, reassessing risk in your portfolio, and getting, I think, in line for some of the best value opportunities in a lifetime. Quite frankly, I think if you move out on a time frame, 3 to 5 years, the emerging markets will offer very compelling values. They are compelling values today, but one thing we know, how the pendulum swings in the market, you go from overvaluation, extreme levels of overvaluation, to extreme levels of undervaluation. You should never buy a fair value stock. Why? Because you don't know which way the pendulum is swinging. You should be selling when you're at extreme values of overvaluation, and you should be buying when you're at extreme levels of undervaluation. We're not there yet in the emerging markets. Even though they're a fair value relative to U.S. stocks, they should still be avoided until they reach that extreme level, and I'd say the same of U.S. equities. We will have that opportunity over the next 3 to 5 years, and a reallocation process from gold ounces and treasuries into that kind of a position, I think, will be the making of millionaires in this decade.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.